Hi, this is an awesome day. How are you, Gulnaz?
I'm doing well, or as well as one can be in a lockdown in Copenhagen on Saturday evening.
Copenhagen is an awesome city. I have like it's interesting because I have seen people there, like the startup ecosystem. People are chill, the like easy with each other. Maybe because it was like in like the setting was not like challenging, but I was when I was in Copenhagen, it was very fun talking to people, understanding what they are doing, and like people help each other a lot, like crazy good from my perspective, and it was very interesting. So yeah, lucky that you are in Copenhagen. It's a nice city in the summer. I'm not sure like now how does it look like, raining?
It's well, the thing is that I think a big misconception about Copenhagen is that people think that it's Scandinavia, it's Nordics, it gets really cold during the winter, but it's actually not that cold right now. So I think the majority of the days it's around 0, maybe 2 degrees. It's very rarely snowing, and it's very rarely a freezing temperature. So I think this winter has been pretty gray and rainy. I think for me the hardest thing is not even the temperature, but just that you don't have that much sun. So pretty much since November, from November until like I don't know, February, March, there isn't much sun. And funny thing here, this past December, on average, every day we had 5.5 minutes of sunlight. Not hours, minutes, 5.5 minutes. It was one of the darkest Decembers for the last like 60 years or so. But
Oh,
summer is
that's bad.
fantastic. Summer is
Oh,
fantastic. I mean, from
I
May
love it,
till end of September is so good. So good.
I used to walk. I didn't say that out loud, not to sound crazy. I used to walk for like 2 hours, crazy amount. It's like I used to go places I don't know where I am. But the nice thing about Copenhagen is the transportation. Like from anywhere, I just take the train or like bus and I go back. So I used to walk like crazy. Like go to places that I've never known it exists, and it was very fun. We didn't start by introducing you, so
Oh, yes, true, true.
why don't you introduce yourself? Of course, I know you. I can introduce you, but it's better to say it on your words.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Gulnaz. Right now I'm the CEO and founder of a tech company, fashion tech company called EasySize. And at EasySize, we are helping customers of online shops find the right size and fit for clothing and shoes that they're buying online. Obviously, a problem that a lot of people are familiar with. You go online, you're not sure what size to buy. And what we do there is we help you to figure that out without using any measurements, be that body measurements, so photos of yourselves, videos, or whatever it is. So we do it in a very simple way, very accurate, reflects your style and fit. And then with that, we help online shops to increase their revenues and decrease their sales. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, what I do. And then on top of it, there are a couple of other things that I work on. So one of them is in my spare time when I have some. I write for Forbes as a contributor, covering topics of fashion and e-commerce and sustainability. And also last year, I had a chance to try myself as an angel investor. So I was a part of an angel program by Atomico, where I was given 100K US dollars to invest in companies of my choosing. So there are very little requirements in terms of like what those companies are. And I ended up investing in 7 companies, which was a lot of fun. And I think it'll be really nice to try again to start investing. Maybe not right now, maybe later this year. So yeah, so
That's
that's just
really
a little
cool.
bit.
Is it it's I don't know if it's a good question or not. Like, is it strictly women or everyone? Like, you open to invest in anyone?
So the trick with Atomico program was that they essentially gave us money. They selected 16 people, 15 or 16 people in the last program. They gave us the money, and then we could choose ourselves what we wanted to invest in. So each one of the angel investors, they tried to figure out what their focus will be. For me, mm-hmm. what I've decided to focus on is I've decided to invest only in underrepresented founders. So women, mm-hmm. immigrants, people of color, and so on. The second one, in terms of the vertical, I focused on verticals that I have experience in, like fashion, e-commerce, technology, B2B, SaaS, and also industries that I'm very interested in. So for example, mm-hmm. Femtech. It's an area that I feel like is super interesting. There is so much stuff happening right now. I don't have experience in it, except for being a woman. And it was very interesting for me to invest in companies and learn from them. So that's essentially, that was my investment thesis. But of course, it was okay. individually different for each angel.
Okay, so Femtech is any technology related to women? So
to women like, health. Yeah, women
health. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's new to me. I've never that's first time to hear about the term femtech, which is means that
it's super interesting because it's really, I think the industry is really picking up now, but like 5 years ago or maybe even 3 years ago, if you mention, people will look at you at like a mad person, but right now it's really picking up. And I think it's the interesting thing there. It's really going beyond just like very, you know, obvious ones, like with period tracking apps and fertility mm-hmm. apps and so on. Like, for example, now there are some tools to address, like, you know, some other issues, like, for example, menopause or creating stronger communities for women going through different changes in terms of their health, mm-hmm. pregnancies, and so on. So it's really an interesting industry. And it was very interesting for me to see that it has been overlooked for so long. And also the amount of stigma around this industry as well. Because still a lot of those topics, they're like not publicly discussed and they're taboo in a lot of places.
Wow. So it's like those startups are operating in Europe only, or does like those companies cross boundaries? Because I'm like from Egypt. If there is like Middle East, basically mm-hmm. whatever you say taboo, that's like impossible in Egypt. So it's like my assumption is like, is it gonna go there at some point, or... That's like far.
I think it will, because essentially one thing that we've realized over the last couple of, decades as a scientific community and community in general is that female and male health is very different. But the way we develop drugs, the way we develop treatments right now, it's pretty much mainly focused or centered around male health. Of course, because anatomies are different and, you know, it just makes sense that we will start investing more into, you know, personalized medicine, personalized healthcare. And as a first start, there is a female healthcare. So I think when it comes to femtech, it will grow across different markets. It's just a question which of those solutions and tools and will start first.
Yeah, yeah. I was just like thinking, like trying to comprehend what you're saying. It means that whatever we have been doing for the last thousands of years, we need to rethink, kind of. It's not like it's a big issue if we are thinking about, let's find the differences in like the anatomy and like everything. Let's look deeper how things work. Let's see the things that we overlooked. I have read a lot about the sexism that happened in the medical industry and women, and how they overlooked the some clear evidence that things are different. They said, no, it's not different. Let's get going. Like the 50s and 60s were very bad time. And it's weird and interesting that we are considering this now. It's a very good start. But let me ask you, when you talk about EasySize, how did you see the opportunity? How did you start it? Because like looking at the idea of size, is it really an issue, the size and the right fit and the right style?
Very shortly, yes. It is actually a massive problem. And the biggest problem there is because there is no one standard size. So, for example, if you go and buy a shirt from Nike in a size medium and a shirt from Calvin Klein in a size medium, they will likely fit you very differently. Even within one brand, especially if you have bigger brands like H&M or Zara or even like Nike again, right? Often they will have different sizes depending on the collection and depending on where it's produced. So that's just how the industry operated. And I think we could really trace it back to the moment when we started mass producing clothing. Because before that, you know, let's say in the 18th century, whatever, everything was tailor-made. And still there are countries where a lot of it is still tailor-made. But when we went into mass production, then pretty much every brand started running on its own. There were a lot of attempts to standardize it, but it never really evolved into anything. So what we have right now is pretty much the Wild West with sizes. And what it leads to massive returns. So if you take fashion e-commerce as an industry, it's an industry with probably the highest return rate. So around 30 to 40% of clothing that is bought online, and clothing and shoes that is bought online, and they are returned. It's a massive waste if you think about it from different perspective, right? From the perspective of disappointed customers, from the financial point of view for companies, as well as the sustainability angle as well, how much of it is being driven back and forth. It is a really big problem. And we especially saw it now with COVID when obviously retail stores were closed, so people could not go in and try on things. It was very much, e-commerce was growing really rapidly. So it meant that people had to figure something out. I think like that pretty much explains. And I think if we try to understand why this problem hasn't been really solved until now, like, of course, there's that industry problem with sizes. There is also a problem that I think when conceptually, when we think about sizes, we think I get my body measurements and then I get garment measurements, like a t-shirt measurements, and I compare it and I'm good to go. But in reality, it doesn't work like that. And in a lot of cases, actually factors like your style and how you want to wear this item, like do you wear it on top of something or on its own? Is it cotton? Is it stretchy material or not? So all of those factors, they will impact the final satisfaction that you got as a customer have.
Okay. So basically, the amount of ways that one can consume a piece of garment means that it's sort of endless. Like I can put it on top of things, underneath, up, down, cut it, like do it in so many ways. Like it's personalization problem from what you're saying. So basically that's sort of huge. So how did you figure this out 6 years ago? It's like, was like there's example like where you started this?
I think for me, it came from my personal frustration. Because I, even at that time, I in general don't like going to stores and malls. I would always try to buy things online. And at that time, I was living in Moscow and I was ordering a lot of stuff from international websites like ASOS and Alibaba or whatever, eBay and so on. And then so many times I will order something, it will take a month or so to get it delivered with Post Russia at that time. And then I will be all excited, I'll try it on and it just doesn't fit. I started looking for a solution and then I found a couple. So there were already a couple of solutions, but all of them were focused on body measurements. And I realized that the majority of my shopping I was doing while I was sitting at my corporate job. Of course, I'm not going to stand in front of my office and start measuring myself or, you know, twirling around the camera. I also felt really uncomfortable taking my measurements. It's almost like every time I take my measurements, I start thinking about, okay, maybe I should lose some weight. Maybe I should go exercise or whatever, right? Yeah. So I started asking myself, like, there must be a better way to do that. And that's essentially how I started looking into this. I've never worked in fashion industry before, so I came very much from the like sort of technology background, and I've decided like, all right, let's try to figure that out. And my goal was to solve it in a way that will be scalable. So I wanted to have that scalability built in the product, and I wanted to do it in a way that will be super easy for people. No measurements, nothing like that. A couple of simple questions and then you're good to go.
That's awesome. Did you consider using augmented reality in this, it makes sense. Like,
Well, at that time, AR wasn't really a thing, but the first idea actually I had about the product was that let's build a mobile app, because at that time everyone was building a mobile app. Let's build a mobile app. You upload two pictures or you take two pictures of yourself. And then from there, we kind of guess your measurements. We get size charts from brands, we map it, and then it works. And that's kind of where I realized that this is not going to work, the approach itself, because the thing is like, And this is, again, a little bit talking about the history, how it works, right? Like right now, if you think about it, the sizing decision is fully on your shoulders as a shopper. You as a shopper have to figure that out. And I think it's just unfair. It really is something that the industry sort of screwed up. And at the same time, we expect shoppers to figure that out. So I've realized that the solution itself should not be very complex. So it could be accurate, but it shouldn't be too complicated for people to do. And that's what we had when we released the app. We launched the app. We saw a lot of people downloading it. And then no one was using it because people were like, yeah, I'm not adding my pictures. Like, this is too much of an effort to get a size. And it's also because it was much easier for them to just say, okay, screw it. I'm just going to order two shirts, try it at home, and that's it. So in terms of the effort, it was much easier. And that's why that was the month when I realized that it has to be, first of all, built in into the user journey. So it has to be a very natural step there. It has to be super, super effortless. So as a customer, it should not take like 10 seconds, more than 10 seconds for you to go through that. And it needs to be ideally in the future, more or less automatic. You know, the more we learn about you, the more we know, the more personalized it is. So you as a customer never have that desire to just order another size and try it at home.
Okay, so the current experience, basically you integrate with the stores and they basically select, like if I had Nike, I just choose Nike, even if I could be on Adidas website, or how the experience looks like now.
Yeah, so we have a couple of different products right now. Actually, at the moment, our most popular product is a product that we sell to brands that sell directly to their customers. So like, just to give you an example, like, you know, let's say you want to buy Nike, you can go to Nike.com website, or you can go to like whatever, Zalando in Europe, or, you know, something else, Neiman Marcus in the US, and buy it from their side. So right now we're focusing on those that are selling directly. And in that case, we actually adjusted our solution to not show or to not ask you about other brands, because a lot of brands did not feel comfortable showing logos of other brands on their website. So right now, the way it works, you go to a website, and on the product page, we either automatically recommend your size if you're a regular on that website or if you have tried us before. If not, we will prompt you with a button, and then you click on it, and we ask you a couple of questions like, what sizes do you usually wear, and how often do you go size up, size down, and what fit you prefer, and so on. So it's typically five or six questions, takes 10 seconds, you answer that, and then from there on, we just recommend you automatically on any other product page you check.
This is really cool. The question here is, how like, what are the numbers? Like, is it like success, this strategy? Is it working?
Yeah, I mean, for shops, it's working really well, especially we've seen for shops that are new. So like, let's say if you are a new brand, you launched like maybe over the last 6 months, and not a lot of people know about you yet, having this solution is really a game changer. First of all, it increases your sales conversion. So you make people more confident about purchases, typically around 60%. So 60% increase in the sales conversion from a product page view. The other one is it decreases your returns. So in terms of, again, we talked how big the returns are. So there it's usually around 25 to 30%. And then finally, it also decreases the amount of customer success or like customer support message you get. So that's also one thing that we've realized. It's like a lot of brands we work with, before they start with us, they will tell us like, typically number one or number two request, it's what size should I buy? So it kind of a lot of different things that helps, but returns and sales, that's the most obvious one.
This is really cool. The question is, where did you start it? Did you start it like, because I know you from Denmark, like we met in Denmark.
Yeah.
You said it started in Russia. So did you start in Russia or Denmark?
I mean, I really started it in Denmark, but I guess the idea was in my head for some time. You know, like how you sometimes get that idea and you start looking and thinking about it and it just stays there in your head. Rent-free, right? And you just like keep coming back to it. So I think that's kind of was the experience for me. And then what happened while I was in Moscow, I was not even working on it really full-time per se, but I went to a startup pitch competition. And there I was pitching the product, and I met a guy who was running Startup Bootcamp in Copenhagen, Lars Buch, there at that conference.
Oh, I love him. Yeah.
And it was a really
I honestly...
Yeah.
I love this guy. I wish to go to Copenhagen to meet him, like shake his hand and just go back. Sorry for interrupting, but it's just I admire him. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a really a straight shooter, I would say. What happened is I pitched the idea and he was like, I hate this. This is a terrible idea. Don't waste your time. Go do something else. As a person, I think it really bothered me to hear that feedback. So what I did, we had an after party. So I grabbed some drinks. I came to him and I said, okay, here's your drink. While you're drinking, tell me why you didn't like it. Like, I need some more tangible feedback. And we started talking about it and he shared some feedback. It totally made sense. And then he was like, why don't you apply for the acceleration program in Copenhagen? Which I did. And I think 2.5 months later, I was invited to selection days. I came to Copenhagen for 3 days, loved the city, loved the team that worked at Startup Bootcamp. And he told me like, okay, you're invited. We start a program in 2 weeks. And I still have a corporate job. I had a really well-paid banking job at that time. So I took the flight back to Moscow. And on Monday, I met with the vice president that I was working with. And I said, listen, I'm quitting. And then he started offering me like, okay, I'll increase your salary even more. And I'm like, yeah, I was so sick and tired of that job at that time. So it just felt like, I don't even care if it works out or not. I just want to give it a shot. And 2 weeks later, I moved to Copenhagen.
Awesome. Awesome. So you are now an immigrant.
Yes, I am.
How does it feel? Because I'm sorry to say it sounds a little bit like maybe racist, but usually immigrants are not white. So is it much different? Like, do you get the messages like go back to your home or stuff like that? Or?
Well, that's the thing because, you know, in my country, in Russia, I actually come from an ethnic minority. So in my country, I would say like I still because I'm light skinned and you know I'm blonde and so on, I will be pretty much white passing. So in a lot of cases people will just assume that I'm an ethnic Russian. But as soon as I would hear my name, they you know, that will be some kind of discrimination one way or another. For example, I remember when I was renting my first apartment, I had to ask a friend of mine to call people because as soon as they will hear my name, they will say like, yeah, we're not renting out, and then some slur word. So for me, when I moved to Denmark, it was a little bit odd because suddenly I was the white person, right? So I didn't get that treatment in a way, right? And again, I think like if you just walk around the city, like it's probably like I can easily pass for a Dane. I think it becomes more tricky when you start talking to people and they realize that, all right, you don't speak Danish and, you know, you come from a different country. And of course, Russia as a country as well, like everyone has opinions about that country. And everyone wants to hear your opinions about that as well. So I think that was like one side of it. When it came to me being a founder, I would say that one of the biggest challenges I had in Denmark, it was around me being an immigrant, because especially in the beginning when I was raising my first round of investments, one of the most common questions I will get was, so when is your visa expiring? Or like, what is your like status in the country? Which was really bizarre because I actually do have a self-employment residency, like visa, which means like my visa is connected to my company. So therefore, if my company is sound, then I'm here as well. And it was really interesting for me to see the difference that when I was talking to investors in other countries, in Europe, like France, the UK, Germany, that has never been a concern. So not once I think I was asked about my immigration status. So it was really interesting to see that difference. And I'm not sure whether it was because I was in Denmark and it's just a tighter community or something else.
Okay. So basically it still happened. Like the glitch. So that's really interesting. So in general, was it easy to hire and get people around your company? Usually it's difficult, and being immigrant, it's even more difficult because, as you said, the company, the whole thing is depending on you, and you depend on the company, and there's like circular dependency. And like when you start hiring, is people questioning your like basically is it gonna be going? Because it's not just I'm gonna lose a job, it's I'm gonna lose a job and like a reason to stay. Like if someone, like, assuming that it's a team of immigrants, like usually now it's weird. Teams are super diverse. Like for the last 7 or 8 years, all the teams that I have worked with, basically it was like interracial. Like there's lots of like races in one team. So it's for me, I think it's good because everyone adds something to the team, and that actually should be the standard. It's like we should be open for those ideas to come in. But how does it look like when you are basically, you have this challenge, and basically you are a solo founder, which you have to convince everyone. It's not just like you are having someone else to back you up. It's like you are the solo founder, and you have basically to take it with the, like, up and down, like up with the investor, down with the employees. So how with that?
I would say that I will look at it from two perspectives, right? First of all, what's happening on the outside, and then secondly, like what's happening inside, like personally, how it feels, right? When I talk about what's happening outside, I think in a way, like from the very beginning, and that was also one of the reasons why I decided to start a company in Denmark, is that I wanted to build a company that won't be a Danish company or a Russian company. I wanted to build an international company. So for me, it was super important that the product we built is not local, it's global, and that was reflected in investors. So even in the very first round of investments, we had investors from the US and India and Singapore and France and Germany, so pretty much all over the world. And that's what I wanted to reflect in my team as well. So for me, it was actually, I was happy to hire immigrants in the country because that's kind of the vibe we were creating in the company. And I think in a way, it also worked the same way as well. So in the early days, it was fairly easy for us to hire people because a lot of internationals, they had hard time finding jobs in Copenhagen because they didn't speak Danish or because they didn't understand Danish culture. So for us, it was not a problem, and it allowed us to hire the right talent. I think now what I'm realizing is that the further you go as a company and the more leadership talent you need, the more of a challenge it becomes. Because I think when with leadership jobs, it really becomes more of a network that you have. And if you don't have an existing network in the country, then it's an issue. So for us, for example, this became really obvious around like maybe a year and a half or two ago, because for a long period of time in Denmark, we had a pretty right-wing government, and immigration into the country was insanely hard. So we lost a couple of very good talents because we could not just bring them to the country. So that's why like late 2019, we've decided that we will go full remote as a team. As a way for us to attract the right talent that we needed, because we were like really hitting the wall, not being able to attract the right people that we want to the company. And I would say like now we've been running as a fully remote team for more than a year. And that has been fantastic because we now have people working all over the world and just really, really top-notch talent. So I really felt like we've been able to address that. The second issue was leadership talent because we just expanded the search. And of course, because remote work became much easier. Yeah. But if you had a question.
No. I was just thinking that, like, the idea basically, do you get together because I still think people need to meet, and like, remote is fine. I love it. It's cool. It's flexible. But at the same point, we have the problem of the human connection. It's like, do you know your team? Like, did you see them in any other context other than jobs and work and that? So that's my problem was remote is fine, but I think it should be like 30 to 50%. More than that, it start eating the spirit. It's like the cause, and like, do you have enough time together or not? That's basically
it's a super, super good point. I actually think that that's one of the biggest challenges with remote that my team has. I would say like two things actually. One of them is overworking. I've realized that it has been so easy to overwork with remote. And secondly, it's like this internal informal connection that you have with people. Our plan initially when we had this whole remote switch was that we will be able to meet everyone like maybe every quarter or every half a year or like two or three times a year for an offsite. And of course, that didn't happen last year because of Corona, but it's still a plan for us to do it. But we've been trying to complement that with other things. Like, so, for example, sometimes we play video games together online. That has been a lot of fun. We have informal chit chats with each other. We are now, like, next week or a week after, we are trying for the first time a live cooking session. So one of the one of the teammates, yeah, she picked a meal and we will be trying it. So I think it's really about finding different ways. I do think that people have that desire to know each other. And of course, we want to build a strong culture. So we'll have to experiment and find what works for us. For now, it's working really well. I'm really happy with remote. And answering your question, actually, the majority of my team right now, I've never seen them in person. So it's really the new way to do it. But I think done when it's done well, remote can really be a good way.
I really like your perspective. It's optimist from like one side. It's like the honestly, there's a weird thing where when you are around people, you actually, it's not just the communication and the language itself, it's the energy. It's like when you are in the same room. Like I remember when we was in Startup Bootcamp in Copenhagen. It's like one thing that happens, the whole office is like dancing or moving or doing one thing together. It's like it was really nice because sometimes it's so silent and so blue and suddenly someone do something. It's like, hey, and it's like the energy is full up and everyone is like start like more energetic and going back to their desk. And it's like it's fun. So this is where I think it's it needs to be more done in a more like more thinking about it. It's like you can have clusters. Like I would think about it. It's like you can have like three people in, let's say, Malaysia or four people in London or stuff like that. A cluster that can meet and sit together because it's needed. It's like people need to see each other. I don't know. Like COVID showed us how much we need people.
Yeah.
Somehow. So yeah, this is how I think about it. But I really like your approach. I think like having activity, it will show some personality and it will give some idea of like what's going on. So yeah, I kind of agree. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also like, if I am to think about COVID, I don't know how it was with you, but I've also realized that it helped me strengthen some of my friends that I had with people, especially people that I haven't been able to see for a long time. Like, I was thinking about it and now I have like a couple of very close friends and some of them I haven't seen for years. But during COVID, we actually were able to talk even more often, you know, having calls, having chatting with each other on an ongoing basis. So I didn't feel that, you know, I don't know them anymore or I don't have that connection with them anymore. So I really think it's about like finding the right way for people. Like, but it's a long way to go. Yeah.
I think it's about like the bootstrapping, like at least the start. Mm-hmm. At least you need to know the person. It's like you need at like one point where you know the person and it's like maintenance mode after that. It's like the start, like you need to invest, then maintain. So this is what I'm talking about. It's like in relationships, I think it's like that because it's a relationship by definition. So basically knowing someone, like you need to invest some time with them, then yes, we can be remote forever because we know each other. And the incremental change you will be able to maintain because the connection will allow for that. So we have been talking for a while. let me ask you the next question, which is like why the fashion industry didn't find like come up with your solution? Like why no one is doing like this standard? Because I see it as like, does the fashion industry is so difficult? Like, my understanding fashion from the movies is, like, very difficult to get into and it's, like, crazy and the art and, like, marketing is, like, everything is, like, super crazy in this industry. So, like, from your perspective, do you have, like, a good, like, mini intro for the fashion industry where, like, explaining the position of your solution?
It's a good question, and I think it has changed a lot over the years because the landscape has changed as well. Like the industry itself has changed. So I would say, like when I was starting it, it was very much still like very closed industry. So there were a couple of big players, and it was extremely hard to break into that. Because if you wanted to start a brand, you had to have so much knowledge, so many connections, knowing, you know, where to produce it and who to produce it with. And it also cost you a lot of money because everything, you pretty much had to build everything from scratch. So what we have seen over the last couple of years, and I think e-commerce is, I'm speaking about e-commerce mainly here, is that that industry has been growing so rapidly and changing so rapidly. What we have today, I think it's a very different industry from what we had when I started the company 6 years ago. So today, I have a lot of hope in a specific segment, which is called direct-to-consumer brands. A lot of them, they're small and medium-sized companies. A lot of them, they're still, or for a very long time, are founder-led. And it really often starts by people who are not from the industry whatsoever. They just come up with an idea like, I want to, like one of the companies we work with, a guy decided to start a company because he used to work as a consultant and traveled a lot. And he wanted to create a shirt that will be wrinkle free and odor free. And if you spill something, it will still be fine because he was a young guy. He spent so much time in hotels and he didn't have time for it. Right. And this is a great example because he found people who developed that technology. And then he found factories that could work with him. He built his website on Shopify. And here you go. You are able to start and run the business. So the barriers to access this business, they've been much lower. And that's what I'm super excited about, this like new generation of direct-to-consumer founders that are building businesses because they have the passion for a particular problem or particular product. And they're just kind of disregarding those like, you know, taboos and stigmas around different things or how things should be done in the industry. And they're just going ahead. And also with that, you have the industry that facilitates that with plug-in play kind of solutions, be that e-commerce platforms or factory setups or shipping solutions and so on. And I think that's really where the industry is going today.
That's really cool. So basically what's happening now is the fashion industry is being revolutionized by like technology and other people. So basically what you're saying is those big titans is losing the grip over the market.
I would actually say that, especially during COVID, and that's the assumption I'm running with, right? Because, of course, I don't know if I'm right or wrong. We'll probably see it in a couple of years. But what I think is happening with the industry now is that there are two types of players that are going to win in the long run. One of them is Amazons of the world. So like massive marketplaces with they have already been quite big for a couple of years. The pandemic that accelerated their growth, and they have the resources to kind of capitalize on that momentum. And then the second segment, it will be small and medium-sized companies, like, you know, very small, scrappy businesses. In a lot of cases, businesses maybe that people even do as side hustles because it's so easy to start today. You know, you go on Shopify, you got your web store, you have all those plugins, you started it, and here you have, right? Everything in the middle, those are the guys that will have a hard time. And they will, I think they will either go into one page or one side of this or another, or they will find some very, very specific niche. Like I've seen it, for example, now with a couple of marketplaces. Like let's say there are some marketplaces that they sell. They say, we only sell sustainable brands. That's our niche, okay. And we just grow there. Or another one, they sell, okay, we only sell modest fashion, right? Because that's the industry we go after, and that's it. So I think that's essentially what will be happening in the industry. So those Amazons of the world and kind of like small direct-to-consumer brands, those will be at the end of the day, the winners.
Here in US, in the US, there is, I see that big names are start falling, like because of the, there is no retail. And like, I think COVID was the last straw for them. It's like everyone is like was shaking already. And when that happened, everyone is like, basically losing it. So do you think that all whoever it's like H&M and like Macy's and all those big names will vanish in the future, as you said? Or like, because my understanding is it will be either a super mega size like Amazon's and or either like the specialty places were like small shops like Shopify based stuff like that. So do you think that those big names will vanish, or like, because I'm trying to comprehend the situation, like do they still make enough money to keep going? Or because the shops are very expensive to maintain, the staff, like everything. So
I mean, and so still the thing is, go ahead. The thing is that the fashion industry had so many problems before the pandemic started. You know, we can spend another 5 hours discussing that, but I would say, like, you know, some of the signs we've gotten, it's of course was for example, the overproduction in the industry. So this is the industry that has never really had proper way of forecasting how much they need to produce. For a lot of standard brands, their production cycle is so crazy that usually they will today be planning what they need to have in stock and sell to people in a year and a half or 2 years. Okay. So that's kind of how much in advance they will be planning in a lot of cases their collections. And it means that when they do it that way, there is very little data for them to rely on. So what end up happening is that around, and it's a rough estimate, that around 25 to 30% of all fashion that is produced is, it's not never going to be sold. People just don't need that. They just produced it because they didn't know, right? Or something else happened. So that's one problem. So it's already was there. Then what happened was the pandemic, especially for those players that relied heavily on retail or didn't have e-commerce, is that suddenly they also were not able to sell anything whatsoever. So today, all those like big brands or even small brands, retail stores, they have their summer collection, spring collection. They have a lot of them, even winter collection, that they have not been able to sell whatsoever. And now we are getting into like almost a year of the pandemic, right? So they suddenly had much more inventory that were not able to release. And it's not just the inventory that you don't have the money for, like, you know, money coming for, but it's also like you need to pay for your warehouse, you need to pay for, you know, things being stored there and so on. So that's kind of the what became a big problem for a lot of those retail stores. And I think this, there are, it's less of the case, I would say, here in Europe. But I think also the reason why is because a lot of those retail stores, they really, well, first of all, they haven't, there are not that many of those big, big stores. And a lot of them, they've been trying to get into online for a long time before as well. So I think that's kind of what saved them a lot. But yeah, it is interesting to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So I have a big question. Looks like a couple of questions. Can we say that Easy Size in some way help in the sustainability? Because like, as someone who's, I didn't care about this stuff before, but when like I left Egypt and like started to see other things, I found that sustainability is a big issue. Being like understanding what I'm doing, what I consume, it's like being careful not to basically over consume, because it doesn't, like, stuff is like very cheap now, but basically being able to buy it doesn't mean that I should buy it. Hello? Gulnaz, oh. Hello? Gulnaz disappeared. I'll try to ping her, see. It's for me, it's exciting so far. I'm learning a lot about the fashion industry and how things are happening. It's very interesting, the amount of like small thing like size can impact the sales and like the metrics of big companies, like the big fashion names, like the amount of work they have to do to make sure that you get the right size. And you still don't get the right size, and the lack of standardization and the issues in the personal taste itself. It's very interesting. And like the way the industry work, basically clothes is not just a piece of thing we wear. It's much more than that. Hi.
All right. Sorry about that.
It's okay. Yeah. It's fine. We were talking about the sustainability issue, and I was saying that like the fact that I can buy stuff doesn't mean that I should buy it. So like, do you think Easy Size does like achieve that? And plus, does it really save billions in wasted resources?
Yeah, it's a good question. Fashion, and I keep saying that it's a good question because you do ask good questions. It's not just like
I honestly, I was questioning myself because it's like you're being nice. But yeah,
So okay, go ahead. With fashion, so first of all, one thing that a lot of people don't know is that fashion is the second most polluting industry in the world. So the only one that is ahead of it is oil and gas. And the reason why is that in a lot of cases, fashion, like the production of fashion items, is it requires a lot of resources. And the other part is because, as we've discussed, there is a lot of overproduction. And then finally, there is also, if we talk about fashion e-commerce, it's a question of what happens with returns. So the reality is that a lot of returned items today, they're never going to be sold again. A lot of brands will burn them. A lot of them will just dump them at the landfill. A lot of them will sell it at a fraction of the price. There were a lot of big cases over the last couple of years. Like, for example, that was the case with Burberry, when they were caught pretty much dumping their stuff on their landfill because they said, we don't want to do anything with returned items because it will devalue our brand. So that's why it was better for them to just burn it somewhere and then, you know, bury it in a landfill. So that's kind of like all combined together. It's a really big problem. When we look at the impact we have, we focus first on the returns that we're able to prevent. And there is really a lot in terms of what we can do. I would say that if we just take the CO2 emission that is generated because of courier deliveries of returns back and forth, it's enough for us to power up more than 500,000 houses in the US for 1 year. And that's a massive number, right? The second one, it's what we prevent in terms of the items that are not being sold and used. And there it's like, it's a lot of it, for example, use of water. So if we take, for instance, a production of one t-shirt, it takes more than 2,000 liters of water to produce. And it's drinking proper quality water, right, if you think about it. So now calculate how much of it is about, you know, how much of it like people consume in a year. And then the final part is also when it comes to items is how long you wear them. And one thing that we realized is that when you get items that fit you well, you tend to wear them more often. And I think maybe you've noticed that as well. Like, you know, I have a pair of jeans that I really like and that sits well on me. And I could just keep wearing them all the time. And then I have another pair, which is a little bit too tight, a little bit too loose. And, you know, you wear it sometimes. So that's kind of how we look at it. And we actually started also calculating that impact on a monthly basis for ourselves as well, to see what kind of impact we have. And also communicating it to brands as well, so they understand that this is not just about having more sales or better net revenues. It's really about making sure that with every purchase, you're making better for the planet as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never thought it is that taxing on the planet to just get like t-shirt. It's interesting.
Yeah.
So I have a question related to that. Why I feel that brands are not interested in showing this aspect of the industry? Like, I mean, I was like just popped to my head. Why don't they just put the number of like how much did we consume from the planet, how much emission did we do, how much like as like they have this nice ticket about like how it's made, that's like this percent cotton, this percent polyester, and like why don't they put more of this information, because I would like to be more responsible in my consumption.
Yeah, well, some brands do that. Like if you take, for example, Allbirds, I don't know if you know that's it's a shoe brand. They also have some clothing now as well. But they've been around for quite some time. And what they've been really focused on is building very sustainable brand. If you go to their website and you pick a pair of shoes and it literally tells you how it's been produced, how much CO2 was used and how many resources were used and so on. But the problem is that a lot of brands are not able to do that because it's really hard to track. If you have a brand, and in fashion in general, it's a very complex supply chain. So you produce like, you know, zippers in one place and fabric in another place, and then you have another factory put it all together and so on. It's really hard to put it all together. And I think there is also that thing that only probably over the last year or two, we've seen that people are genuinely more interested in sustainability. Still, mm-hmm. a lot of cases, people just are driven by prices mm-hmm. and by styles, so trends rather than sustainability. But it's thankfully it's changing. There is a big shift happening now. And I think more and more brands will look into changing that as well. Like, as you said, like showcasing it more, because I completely agree with you. Like, I myself also started paying attention to that while working in this company, and that has impacted my choices a lot. Like, I understood, like, now, for example, I think for the last year, I only tried to buy secondhand, because secondhand is also a way for you to decrease the CO2 kind of impact, footprint, yeah. sorry. So I think over the last year, I almost 90% of things that I bought were secondhand. And I was really mm-hmm. surprised by the experience, and it felt also good, you know, getting something and you feel like, okay, I will wear like this sweater. It's a secondhand sweater and I feel good about extending its life. So I feel like that there is a shift and more people will be doing it soon.
Yeah, I really like that. So that's very interesting. We have been talking about so many topics.
Kind of industry nerdy topics like fashion, e-commerce. I don't know how interesting these topics are for your audience. So I'm happy to shift the gears.
Yeah, here's the thing. The way I treat this is like a space where like we can say anything, do anything that we see that aligns with our beliefs. So basically, the idea of like trying to reach people, it should not distract us from what we believe in. So I'm really interested in listening and hearing your story. Like that's one. Your company is doing very good service, so I would like also to know that. And there's multiple things we could do, like sharing experience, like how human evolve. It's basically people teaching other people things, how we reach to this point. Like I was thinking about, I'm sure that before being able to record things like music, mm-hmm. I'm sure human used to do music and do things, and we missed that because that's not recorded anymore. So yeah. I think it's sort of essential that we record our voice and keep it and leave it for someone. Maybe archaeologists in the future see us and like find out that we were doing something. And I think that's, from one perspective, is very healthy for us and for everyone. I understand that we are not like media figures, but in the same time, we are human. We try to communicate. And personally, I'm not trying to reach to everyone. I'm trying to reach to someone who is willing to listen to me. So this is like, it's like tango, it need two. So someone talks and someone listen. So, and that's what we are seeking for. So far, I like it. It's very interesting. Now there is one interesting topic, is the mental health, because you are a founder. I guess you have been through a lot. I was a founder before. When I had to shut down my company, I got like 6 months in my room. I didn't go out. It's like I was losing my mind. I think you are lucky that your company is still going, but is it heavy or like how does it feel and how are you doing?
Yeah, no, it's I think the whole topic about the well-being and mental health, especially in the startup community, and I would say not even just founders, but even employees, it's such a taboo topic. I like to joke that, you know, you meet a founder and you ask them how you're doing and they'll be, I'm killing it. Everything is just, you know, hockey stick. It's going so well. And then you start talking to them and they start opening up and you understand that everyone is dealing with their own stuff. Everyone is fighting their own battle. And I think because we stigmatize it so much, we are doing so much harm to people because you are getting different signals. Like if you're a founder today, your investors are probably telling you like, you gotta hustle, you gotta push, you gotta work hard. You feel that you can never let you know, your guard down. You feel that you always need to be upbeat and positive because you need to see that, you need to show it to your employees, you need to show it to your customers, you post on Instagram, happy pictures, everything, right? And I think that that's kind of what impacts founders a lot, that we have so much burnout when it comes to the mental health. For me, like I know myself that it's this journey. I love being an entrepreneur. Like honestly, I love it. It's my third company. I worked in corporate before. I will not change it, you know, ever. But it's also so damn stressful. it is so hard in terms of managing that and finding the right balance. And I myself have been through a burnout as well. And I have days when it's been extremely stressful. Last couple of months, we've been growing so rapidly. And naturally, as a founder, I was doing so many things at the same time, like, you know, hiring and raising investments and figuring out market strategy. And December has been a hell month for me, because there were weeks and days when I barely went outside. I was just working day and night. And of course, it has its impact. I think for me, when it comes to burnout and mental health, I kind of found for myself a system that consists of three pillars. And I'm telling it because it took me a long time to find it. And it was kind of based on the conversations that I had with a lot of people. And I hope that founders, or just in general, anyone else who maybe feel that they're getting burnout, they could use this. Maybe it will have some impact on them. So the first pillar, what I found out, is what I call systematic issues. So it's usually either some kind of pressure points in your work. For example, if you're a founder, you're probably always stressed out about running out of money, or if you're fundraising, or like, you know, maybe losing an employee and so on. So you have a lot of those stress thoughts and things that are happening. It also could be just some tasks that are really draining, like, for example, some routine tasks for people, right? Maybe if you're a developer, there is like a routine task that you need to do that is really draining. And it's very easy to identify, because as soon as you start doing it, you just feel like, oh my God, I want to kill myself right now because this is too much, right? Or you try to avoid those tasks for as long as possible. So the most important thing there is to identify those stress points and do everything that you can to avoid, like, kind of remove them from your life. So if it's, let's say, if you're afraid of running out of money, then make it your main goal. And, you know, don't do anything else until you find that money, right? Maybe raise money today and so on. If you think that an employee will leave you, schedule a call, talk to them tomorrow, see if that's okay or not, if they are feeling good or not. So try to address those things, and it makes a big difference. Or try to completely remove them if you can. Like, I've seen with a lot of founders that they will tell me people always feel weird about getting a personal assistant. But if you can get them as soon as possible, because that will be so much better for you. I don't have a PA yet, but I have a few friends who got them, and they were like, oh my God, I feel so much better, because suddenly all those small admin tasks that I need to do is just off my plate. So try to find those things to kind of free up your energy. The second one is physical. I think a lot of founders, they underestimate how much what you consume and what you do with your body affects you. Like, for example, you know, what you eat. We have this let's eat cup noodles and, you know, pizzas every day, or you just grab something on the go, and it's just not healthy. Like for me, for example, last 2 years or so, I've been meal prepping, and I know it sounds super boring, but it's been really great, because I will just prep my lunches and breakfast for a week. And that I know that I'm getting the right nutrition, and I always have it ready. Because for me, the biggest problem is that I will just forget to eat if I'm too stressed, because you have meeting, and you barely have time. Another one is just doing some physical exercise, finding something that is for you. Now I have every day, I just book a time slot and I do some kind of exercise every day, because otherwise it's just, I go crazy. We were talking in the beginning about Copenhagen and how you would go for 2-hour walks. Well, I'll tell you this, like, walking has become my favorite thing now. I've been doing 1, 2, 3-hour walks sometimes on weekends, especially, like, and it's just great to clear your mind. You know, I go to walks. I listen to podcasts. I record myself if I have some thoughts, and it's just fantastic. So I think it's very important to not neglect the physical part. And then the final part is the mental. Like, if you can see a therapist, do that. If you can meditate, do that. Find a hobby. Make sure that you have time to actually spend time with your family and friends and so on. Like, one thing that has been really a game changer for me is to really take my calendar and block out different times in my calendar for different things. Like, for example, my entire morning, like 6 till 9, 9:30 is blocked for my morning stuff. And I don't have any meetings, and it's just a rule. I wake up, I do my meditation, I exercise, I have my breakfast, and then I'm ready to start. And the same way, I have booked like every day at 6 p.m. That's my dinner time, and I don't compromise on that. So I think it's really important to get those routines in place for founders, because otherwise it's so, so easy to burn out and, you know, go down the hill.
Wow. That's well, I think we got much more wise about our mental health when we got a little bit slightly older. By the time we met in 2014, mm-hmm. I was basically in dark place. I was just about to close my company because we are running out of money, and that's where the 6 months were happening. And actually, it was a meeting with, not meeting, it was email from a friend, and he was hooking me up with Lars to bring me to Copenhagen. So this is why, and I think, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's we don't think much about the small things, the small cuts that makes us bleed, like the assistant PA. That's where I was like nodding, yes, get one, because all the small cuts that consumes you, it just go, and it frees up so much time. Like it sounds like 15 minutes and 10 minutes and 5 minutes, but it's just like when you add them up, it's like huge amount of time you spend in exhausting tasks that can any other person do it. Also, yeah. The fact that you meal prep, that's actually interesting, because that decision of what to eat, do I have enough like to eat, stuff like that. It sounds like is it an issue for me? Yes, it sounds like that, because it makes a huge difference. I really like your advice and how you structured it. I have never thought about it. Like that's like a holistic view. That's very interesting. And I really like it. So question.
Yeah. If I'm just to add to this one, like 2 points, I think first one is what a lot of people don't understand, is that it's like, you just only have that much energy and that much, headspace, and every small little thing, you don't think about it. It's just, oh, it's just one call, or it's just one small planning and so on. It's up. And what I've realized as soon as I started implementing those things is that I was freeing up that headspace in my head, and suddenly I was coming up with some new ideas, strategic creative ideas. And it's not that I didn't have them because I was dumb a month ago, right? It was literally because my brain could not process. It was just so occupied with all the small things that it had to run with. So that's, I think, what a lot of founders need to understand, is that, you know, you need to free up that space for you to understand where you want to lead your company towards. And then the second point I wanted to make is that for me personally, like, I'm a planner. I like planning, like having a structure and a plan gives me some comfort. Yes. And that's why as much of as things that I can plan in advance, the better I feel. Like back in the days before COVID, I will literally even plan outfits for every day a week. I will put everything on a hanger. It's like, I take the hanger and then I'm good. I dressed, I can go. I have my prep stuff and I'm good, right? And I think the more of those things you can figure out, so remove that choice. You don't need to think about it in the morning or when you're doing it. Have everything ready, and it will, again, help you out because you just automate and optimize those things.
That's really cool. I also think that the small tasks is very bad for our brains, because that's where we escape. Like, I don't want to just do this big thing. Let me do those little things that I should do. So it's like, I totally agree with you. And I think, I think the idea of planning, it sounds funny because I adopted this like 3 years ago, where I plan like my work. Even I'm an engineer, so I write code. I meet some people, stuff like that. But the way I do it is I plan ahead. And in execution mode, I don't change anything. It's like, we need to change that. No, that's execution. There is, I have this weird division of things. It's like 10% or 20% tolerance and not more than that, because I don't like to compromise my plans. I'm already paranoid. And like when it gets intense, it makes me so nervous. It's like, that's a freak out time because we have been messing up the plan. So, it's either that I go back and talk to stakeholders, I'm not going to be able to deliver that, or basically be honest with everyone. And that's actually one part of like what you were talking about, the employees and like the fear of missing someone or something like that. I think it's essential that we, like, not we, I'm not the founder or like in the startup scene anymore, but I think it's important to communicate the current situation and let people have the freedom to choose. Sometimes, like I was a founder, I was a dictator. So I tried to hide as much information as I can. So basically I use it to my advantage, where like no one knows anything. It's like, the investor knows what I need them to know. The employees knows what I need them to know, and that's it. But I think for the long run, that's not very helpful. Like everyone should know what's going on. And if employee decided to leave, I think, they have the right to do that. And also it will elevate some stress on the founders. That's my guess. I'm not sure if it's right or not.
No, I would say actually, like, first thought here is that, first of all, the more sort of stories you create, the more things you don't tell people, the more you need to use your brain power. So like, did I tell them this or should I tell them that? And you're like, you know, it's so exhausting. And then the second one, when it comes to employees, I think the key here is really when an employee leaves, I'm not offended by them leaving. I understand that things change and so on. What I'm upset about is that I did not see that coming and we didn't have a chance to fix things. And I think that's really a fault on my end to say that I did not create the environment where the employee was feeling comfortable enough to come to me and say, hey, this bothers me, or this is my circumstance and, you know, I'm not feeling happy here anymore. So to me, like, that's how I look at it. And that's what I focus the most on now, is like making sure that I'm always in contact with people and I get a sense of where they're at. Like, for example, we have like regular one-on-one meetings with people and so on. So I can foresee that coming, because if we tried everything and you're still unhappy, then of course I want to help you to move on and find a better place, because, you know, I want people to be happy. But we really need to work on making those conversations happen earlier.
Yeah, that's really cool. So we have been talking for almost an hour. Look, it's an hour and 5 minutes, but I have one last thing. Sorry that it's exhausting to talk that much, but...
No, that's all right. It's like I have any other plans.
Honestly, as I said, it has been 6 years since we had like a face-to-face conversation, and it's really nice that we are basically connecting back. It's nice. There's so much to catch up on. I have last question, which basically it's not for us or anyone. It's like for the newcomers. If you have some advices that you would like to say for yourself, like 7 years ago, someone who's about to immigrate, female or male or whatever, starting a company and think, should I do that or should I do that? Like, now the situation is funny because everyone has his own concerns about like going out and facing life. Like, now basically talking makes people upset. So we need to make sure that we are communicating the right message. Like, when we talk to people, like, it's interesting because for some reason people now are very oriented to their ideas, and it's kind of scary because you saw what's happening in the US when people only listen to themselves. So what is your advice, like couple of advice you give to yourself 7 years ago about like what you should do in life and starting a company, going out, stuff like that?
I think first of all is it's important to, you know, like we talked a lot about mental health, but I think it's really important to understand your own limits, like how much of it are you able to like endure as a person, right? And it could be both in terms of finances, in terms of your relationships, in terms of your well-being as well. And it's very important from the early days, start creating those habits that will help you to stay in the game for long. I think one of the reasons why I've been able to run this company for so long and finally get to the moment where the market has picked up, it was because I was sometimes with more success, sometimes with less, but I've been able to find that balance and keep going. Because if you as a person exhausted, then nothing will help you. So really prioritize your own health and, you know, your own well-being, relationships and so on. The second part is really, I think when it comes to startups, it's really about finding the right people. I cannot stress it enough. And it's not just about employees or founders, it's also mentors and just people from the industry that you're trying to enter and so on. Like, I have a couple of people who are my friends and mentors, and honestly, I cannot express enough how much they help me, both in terms of personal development as well as professional development. And I think having people like that, finding those people, it's so, so important, because your idea might change, your problem might change, your team might change, but if you find the right anchors, find people in your around you, that will be super, super helpful. The other one, and it's not an advice, it's more like an observation. I know in startups, we like saying, you know, fail fast, succeed faster, and so on. And I do understand why, where it's coming from. And of course, I'm not telling people that, you know, you should never give up on an idea and so on. But I do feel like, especially as an immigrant, we have fewer chances to fail fast and succeed faster. I knew, for example, for me, I did not quit many, many times throughout this journey because I knew that my stay in the country was attached to my company. So I always try to exhaust every single, you know, kind of option before doing that. And of course, I wish there were other options. Like, I guess if I had a family in this country, if I had a safety net and so on, maybe my decision making would have been different. But I think with immigrant entrepreneurs, it's really important to understand, like, until which point are you able to go with this? You know, when do you say, okay, let's pull the plug and move on? And when do you say, okay, I need to try it again? Because as an immigrant, you will have fewer options. That's just the reality. I don't say it to limit people's desires and ambitions. I say it more as like, you know, I think that's the reality of life.
Yeah. Understanding the situation that you are about to get yourself into. This is really one of my favorite episodes. I honestly like to learn about other things. I know your company. I like navigating the conversation where we show everything. It's like what you're doing, how the market is going, and it's really exciting and interesting that to see the grow and that the company is doing well now. So if you have any closing remarks, like you have 2 minutes if you would like to use it. Other than that, I don't have anything else to say. So
yeah,
would you like to say anything?
I guess from my side, I would just say that, you know, whoever wants to start a business, I think, you know, go give it a try, weigh all the, you know, pros and cons and then give it a try. I personally feel like becoming an entrepreneur, that was probably one of the best decisions in my life, because only when I started this, I realized how unhappy I was in the corporate world. So it's really about just finding something that you like. In terms of, you know, if anyone wants to get in touch, if I can help you in any way, advise, founder advice, investor connections in Europe or whatever, just reach out to me. I think the best way for me is just follow me on Twitter and ping me there. I go by at Gulnaz. I am Gulnaz K. You probably
will. I would put all your like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook links in the show notes.
Exactly. Just reach out to me. I'm always happy to help. I really believe in this, like, founders helping founders. So I do mean it when I say it.
That's really cool. Awesome. Yeah. So that was very exciting. Thank you so much for the time and like the amazing conversation we had. And I really wish more success to you, and looking forward to have our next conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been super, super fun. And I hope that next we speak sooner than 6 years from now.
I will try to make it sure. Yes. Yeah. I'm looking forward to actually visit Europe and go visit Lars, you, and everyone. It was really nice.
Hopefully soon. Yeah.
Awesome.
Perfect.
Sure. Yeah. Have a good day.
All
bye.
Right. Yeah, you too. Bye.